That's our image of the shtetl. That wasn't the case, particularly in Lithuania. Lithuanian shtetlach, as a rule, were not religious. Many of them were actually anti-religious, with the great exception of Telz. Telz was a college town. All there was yeshiva. So there, the people were just... Their life was Yiddishkeit. It was more than Yiddishkeit. It was being involved in Torah. And for those who weren't involved in yeshiva, they had a break in the afternoon. The workmen, the laborers in Telz, had a break to coincide when the yeshiva had a break. In the hope they could stand on the street and yeshiva bachur would come out and they could, a bachur would ask them a favor, like, what time is it? Or what day is it? And they could actually do a favor for yeshiva bachur. That's how enthralled they were with yeshiva students. But that was Lithuania. In Poland, the shtetl was something like this. And this is something which was thoroughly destroyed. We have no zecher of this today. The only I think of a little bit of kin would be Salford 7 in Manchester. A little bit, it's a reminiscent of a shtetl. Or maybe Gibraltar. But there it's so mixed with non-Jews and non-Jews. It doesn't have the distinctly Jewish flavor. It certainly doesn't look like Eastern Europe and Gibraltar. In the shtetl, life revolved around Shabbos. People worked all week long, and they worked very arduously. They'd get up early in the morning, and often they would come back at night, not because they would start early in the morning, because their work would be governed by the daylight hours. Come back, try and learn, and then they would... But the whole week was preparation for Shabbos. In the shtetl, doing your laundry was a big deal. You hired a big, cumbersome, non-Jewish woman, built more for power than for speed, who comes to your house with her washboards and basins and baths and take all the clothing. You didn't want to be anywhere near her vicinity or near her odor, as she would cook up the clothes and launder them and then hang them to dry. That was about once every two, every 3 weeks. There was a fire, and it was a big production to get the fire going. It was a chachma. You didn't just turn on a pilot. You had an iron grating, and you would light a fire. Some of it akin to a bonfire. Bonfire is so much easier. You just make something combustible and light it. This is much more, because you had to have a bonfire that was controlled. And virtually everybody had a Shabbos goy, or one Shabbos goy to the whole community. How did they pay the Shabbos goy? Before you answer this, you have to realize the thing which drove Polish Jewry was grinding poverty. The average Polish Jew never tasted milchiks. The closest they got was a cup of water. They put a few drops of milk inside to make it cloudy. The girl had one dress. And when she got taller, weekday Shabbos, when she got taller, they would extend the hem. And taller, yet another hem, and then another hem, then another hem. You could almost tell her age like you could count the rings of a tree. You had one pair of shoes, weekday Shabbos. And the toe came out. I'm telling you, you got a pair of shoes when you were 5 years old. That was your shoe, pair of shoes for life. When the toes came out, you put on a patch. The heel came out, you put on a patch. And the sole broke a patch. There are these bulbous appendages, the shoes. So how did you pay the Shabbos goy when there's no money to go around? And it's a critical thing. He's got to turn on the fire, turn off the fire. How'd you pay him? There was something irresistible. Severin thinks it was challah, but that wasn't it. The thing that was irresistible to a Polish guy was challah. Because the bread they ate was very coarse and rough and tasted like wood, cardboardy. But challah was sweet bread that was soft and was such a treat for them. They'd do anything just to get a bite of challah. People would bake. People didn't have ovens. Those people, the rich ones, had the ovens, which I tried to explain to you are very complicated to operate. So what happened was, you want to cook your challah, you'd cook it in the baker's oven. The baker obviously wasn't doing business over Shabbos, so his oven would be emptied out, and everyone would have some kind of simen on their pot. And there was an eruv around the shtetl, and people would bring their challah on Friday to the baker's oven, and they'd give him a few kopekas for the privilege, or they did barter. Muslim did barter. In other words, one person was an oat merchant. And the baker needed oats. And someone else had a horse. So he would do barter. He would bring the flour to the baker. Everything was done on a barter system. And this way you had the privilege that you could bake your challah pot in the baker's oven. And everybody had some kind of simen on it, so you'd know which pot was yours, you didn't take somebody else's challah. the environment, which was so pervasive, was of a family. People were not related to you, but growing up in a shtetl, everybody was your brother. Everybody was your brother. And when some person made a simcha, it was everybody's simcha. Chalil, if there was misfortune, it was everybody's misfortune. No such thing as, you know, a girl who needs a shidduch that nobody else knows about. Every day by day, what was happening with everyone. And the one who governed, the thing that governed the town was the shul. Generally, the shul was in the center. Life was there, very much surrounded to the shul. Okay. And it was this life, which is so uniquely Jewish, was totally destroyed in the Holocaust. And then you go from the shtetl to the big city. And the biggest city of all was Warsaw. Warsaw was the second Jewish community, second largest Jewish community in the world. Largest being... I feel like in seminary. In seminary, when I ask a question, they all answer, because they think, they know the teacher knows the answer, so they go, they'll think that they're saying the right thing. I teach many years, so I know that means nothing. The largest Jewish community was?
Berlin.
Berlin was for sure not. Krakow was smaller than... You're saying good answers. I mean, the major Jewish communities in Poland were Warsaw, Lublin, Krakow, Katowice, and Lodz. Not in that order. Katowice is smaller than Lodz. But the biggest community, someone said, the biggest community in the world was New York, by far. Then came Warsaw. And because Warsaw was such a large city, it was the center of Jewish life in Poland. Meaning, now Lublin was very large, but the center of Jewish life, if you would be a Bundist is very, very anti-religious. If you'd be a Zionist, if you would be a socialist, your headquarters were in Warsaw. Likewise, if you're a Chassid, a Shiva Bachar, most likely your headquarters are in Warsaw. Thus, when the war broke out, there were thousands and thousands, I'm not saying tens of thousands, I'll be able to read the word, tens of thousands of Shiva Bachrim, that 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, that were left all by themselves, isolated from their families. Their families live in Lublin, in Lodz, and these little shtetlach, which dotted the countryside, and they're all by themselves in the war, isolated from everything. And there was a savior for these boys. His name was Hillel Seidman. There's a book, if you have a library, you may have it, called The Warsaw Ghetto Diaries, which I must admit I never read, but I intend to read it later. The Warsaw Ghetto Diaries is that he was the most high-ranking member of the Judenrat in Warsaw, in the Warsaw Ghetto. He wasn't part of the Judenrat. Judenrat was made of 12 members. He wasn't one of the 12, but the most high-ranking, but, you know, the Warsaw Ghetto had over 500,000 Jews. At one point, it had almost nearly 600,000 Jews prisoned within it. And that requires a large body to run it. I mean, the idea of the Judenrat was something which was doomed to failure. The Nazis wanted the Judenrat exclusively to do the will of the Nazis. And they liked the idea of Jews picking on other Jews and making demands on other Jews. And as we just told you, that since post-Jewry was impoverished, this really frustrated the Nazis. Because the Nazis, like all the anti-Semites in history, actually believed their anti-Semitism. They actually believed they just must have so much wealth and money and resources. And they came there, and where was the money hidden? And they constantly, dynamically, perpetually made confiscations, hoping that this would bring the money which they hoped to loot from the Jews. So they would say to the Judenrat, you have till 5 o'clock in the evening to give us 4,000 golden coins. If not, you'll be tortured and shot. Which was done. And every Judenrat had a backup Judenrat. They were tortured, they were shot. Then the next Judenrat would say, you have till 4 o'clock the next day. But there wasn't the money there. And all they got from Polish Jewry was not the money which they had expected. What they got from them was a skilled labor force that was 3 million strong. Which of course they exploited to the fullest. So, Hillel Seidman is a member of the Judenrat. It's a lose situation. It's not a lose-lose. It's worse than that. So the Nazis expect the Judenrat to do their demands, and the Jews expect their officials to act on their behalf. And what happened was the Judenrat simultaneously saved Jews and murdered Jews. All the time that's what happened. It was up to the Judenrat to allocate distribution of food, to collect the refuse. This required a tremendous engineering skill. That's why, interestingly enough, the head of the Judenrat in the Warsaw Ghetto was Adam Chernyako, a name we otherwise never would have heard of. He was an engineer of no fame whatsoever prior to the war. And the fact that he was an engineer was made him very much well-suited for his job, because it required the head of an engineer to figure out how to distribute food. And what they did was, in every single chutz, where there were Jews, where the Jews were in the ghetto, they made a sort of vat bayit to distribute the food and collect the waste. Now, the food was purchased by the Jews themselves. The Nazis didn't give them food. They had to buy their own food. But the Nazis oversaw what they bought. And they said, you can only buy from this contractor, and they would see to it that they would only supply rotten potatoes, frozen, other horse meat. And many times the food was just not edible. So the Jews had to pay thousands and thousands of zlotys to have Polish contractors come remove the food. And since the food was only brought on a monthly basis through the Umschlagplatz, when the Nazis would see these tremendous quantities of food, by the way, you would freak, every one of you here, if you would see how much food you eat in one day, you would freak. You just can't believe all that goes into you. But here, to feed 500,000 starving people the food that was brought in, even though it was sub-starvation rations, the Nazis said, they don't need so much food. Ridiculous. So much food for the Jews. So they shave off large portions of it, and they would then go sell it elsewhere, which contributed to the total sense of starvation in the ghetto. Hillel Zeidman did all that he could to become the father of these boys. Well, the Shidduchim, they were left by themselves. And because of this, the little portions of food that he was in control of, that he had for himself, he would give to these boys. He was awake all night long trying to soothe them, to ease them, to give them counseling, which made him look, he was a man in his young 20s, made him look like he was at least a grandfather, which ended up saving his life. Because Gute Sternbach was, it's a pretty funny story, Gute Sternbach, when the war broke out, before the war broke out, there was a fellow named Sternbach. Sternbach may be a name familiar to you, because these, Recha Sternbach is the heroine of rescue. The Sternbach family was one of the most important families to do any rescue work during the war. They lived in St. Gallen, Switzerland, which is a border town, like most of Poland, Switzerland is a border town. They had a successful raincoat factory, and they were meiser nefesh to save Jewish lives. And they had written on the trees, you know, on trees usually have a heart, Bob loves Susie. So on the trees it would have their phone number. All they had to do was make it into, as if it's so easy, make it into Switzerland, call that number, or get to that address, and then they'd be home free. In the Sternbach home, there were mattresses all over the floor, there's a table filled with food. The refugees who had been on the run for years would now have a chance to have a warm bath, eat food, and be treated like human beings. And their Mesiras Nefesh was absolutely incredible. They worked, there were times that she went over the border to Germany when Jews were expelled. Now, you have to be aware of the fact that the Swiss are, first of all, extremely unhospitable. And if you've ever been to Switzerland, you think they're hospitable people, that's only because they're making money off you. They're not hospitable people. They don't like strangers. Certainly not Jews. And therefore, if they would ever discover someone who didn't belong there, they would just throw them over the border, or have the police expel them over the border. So Recha Sternbach bribed the head of the St. Gallen Police Department, a fellow named Paul Gruninger. He was on the take. And there were the head of the Swiss Jewish community, his name was Sally Meyer. Sally is a Schwischerdeutsch man's name. Ostensibly, he was a firm Jew. He wore a yarmulke, a lace manufacturer, but he was a Swiss patriot far more than he was a Jew. And he would inform Heinrich Rothmann, the rapidly vitriolic anti-Semitic head of the border control, whenever Jews would come over the border illegally, because he felt that's what patriotism behooved him to do. Then he felt it behooved him, but he told him, Mr. Sternbach, who came to him and said that we have to try and save these Jews who are going to be deported, he said, have you never heard of Dina Malchusadina? And he said to her, I'm a simple Jewish woman, I don't know Gemara. I know I have to save my brethren. And I'm telling you, if you will not save them, and he was the head of the joint in Europe, which meant that he was Providence and placed him in charge of a lot of money, said, if you cannot help them, I will never speak to you again, which he never did. She was then arrested for rescue activities. Her trial dragged on for 3 years. She was thrown in jail. She was not in jail for 3 years. For 3 years, her trial dragged on. In the end, they wanted her to admit who was involved with her smuggling Jews over the border. She said, I'm involved in humanitarian action, and I will never reveal to you anyone to get them in trouble for doing something which the conscience compels a person to do. In the end, after 3 years, they released her. They dropped all charges. And then the prosecutor, who up until this point was just doing his job, trying to land a conviction, took out of his wallet 100 francs and gave it to her as a donation. So did the judge. So did other people in the courtroom. Just very impressed by this woman. She worked in conjunction with Aaron Cutler in America, of trying to get everything possible to save Jews, was using false, usually Panamanian and South American passports to get Jews over the border. One Shabbos morning, they told her that the Bloom brothers from France had managed to come to get into Switzerland. Talking about France, I'm talking about Vichy France. It was a Nazi puppet government. They'd made it to Switzerland. They got into a taxi and asked to go to the Sternbach home, and the driver was suspicious. And he felt, these are probably illegal aliens. Instead of driving to the Sternbach, he drove them to the police station. They were then put in a internment camp, and they were going to be expelled back to France, which meant their death. Anywhere in Nazi-occupied Europe meant going to your death. Switzerland was neutral. She heard about this Shabbos morning. Her husband went to Zurich to try and work with officials, and she got into a taxi, and she went to the border to argue with the people. I don't care if you put them in jail for the rest of their lives. Just don't send them back to France. Sending back to France means you're an accomplice in murder. In the end, she was successful. This was not any Shabbos. This was the Shabbos of their only son's bar mitzvah, which both parents missed. And someone said to the boy, you got the greatest gift in the world for a bar mitzvah. A Jewish life, two Jewish lives were saved. What better life gift could there be? Okay, back to Hillel Seidman. So he, this Gutta Sternbach, who was the sister-in-law of Recha Sternbach, this heroine rescue, one interesting more anecdote, which I'll tell you about her, is that she was not just a person in time of war who did all that she could to save her brethren. She was altogether had all the proper Jewish midos of tzniut, achnasas orchim, anivus. So a friend of mine is married to a relative of the Sternbachs, and he said that after the war, a fellow came to St. Gallen, and he asked the Swiss cop, where is there a kosher restaurant? He pointed to the Sternbach home. The guy came into the house, just walked right in, sat himself down on the dining room table. Mr. Sternbach said, hello. And he said, I would like chopped liver. And he gave her a whole menu to prepare. She said, okay. So he takes out his newspaper. He starts reading the paper. She comes back. She cooks up a meal for him as he specified. She serves it. He finishes his paper, finishes the meal. He says, how much do I owe you? Owe me? What? He said, how much do you charge for the... I don't charge you anything. What do you mean? He said, there's a kosher restaurant. The guy had no idea what Chnasas Orchim is. He sees all the Jews going in there to eat. He assumed there must be a restaurant. These are the kind of people that the Sternbachs were. In any event, it's Recha Sternbach, her husband, Eli Sternbach. And Eli Sternbach's brother is Yitzchak Sternbach. So, on September 1st, 1939, Yitzchak Sternbach was in Warsaw on a business trip. All of a sudden, Germany, Soviet Union invade, and they say all foreigners must immediately leave the country. But when he was there, the business trip didn't start that day, they told him that there's a phenomenal girl for you, her name is Gutta Eisenzweig. And he hears about this girl, and I think this is the shidduch of his dreams. He goes to meet her. He says, I'm very sorry, there's a war going on now. I can't talk to you now. He says, can't we just have a quick little date? She said, no. And after the war, in a few months, we'll, if you're interested in me and I'm interested in you, we'll talk. So he thought this is the one. He goes back to Switzerland, and this war was not for a few months. Anyways, he didn't give up on Gutta Eisenzweig, who's going to become his wife, Sternbach. And when they were in the Warsaw Ghetto, he manages to mail her three passports, one for her, one for her parents. Her father was already dead. And Hillel Seidman manages to go into the Powiak prison, where they're keeping those with Central American passports, assuming this must be her father, even though he was her age. But that's because his Mesiras Nefesh for others had made him look so aged. I saw the scene with my own eyes. Hillel's eye was no longer living. But he would stand on the street corners in Brooklyn. When Shiva Bus would pull up or Bachram would get off, he would just stand there crying. After all the destruction he saw, to see the reflourishing of Jewish life just brought him to tears each and every time. Okay, so we described the shtetl, we described the city, and how Warsaw was just a bustling city for so many, many Jews, which meant a lot of Jews were stranded there when the war broke out. And even though Warsaw was 39.7% Jewish, 4 out of 10 people in Warsaw were Jews, there were streets in Warsaw, if a Jew were to walk down them, they'd be beaten to death. Thus was the anti-Semitism in Poland. It was the most rabid vitriolic period of anti-Semitism from the time of 1935. In 1935, a man who was a very important Polish leader named Marshal Pilsudski died. I don't know if you've ever heard of Janusz Korczak. There's that good old Let's try that again. Janusz Korczak?
Yes.
Who?
No.
Go ahead, who was he?
He was a very big in children's leader. He gave children a lot of like responsibility and would treat them as if they're older. He went with his whole orphanage down to the Warsaw ghetto, and he didn't have to, and he had an escape. But he stayed with...
No, he had to go into the war, into the ghetto. He had an escape out of the...
What?
He had to go into the ghetto. He had an escape out of the train to Treblinka.
But he didn't go.
It's interesting. Chazal says, it's a Zohar. Everything needs mazel. What does that mean? Even a Sefer Torah needs mazel. What does that mean? Tzvi? Has to be a Tzvi here. Josh? You must be joshing. What does that mean? Sefer Torah needs mazel. Okay, I'll tell you what it means. Yes?
It means someone to guard it, like you have a muscle, like a guardian angel.
No. What it means is, think of your shul at home. You probably have in Aron Kodesh 5, 6 Sefer Torah, maybe more, maybe less. But only one Sefer Torah is the lucky one that's read. So even Sefer Torah needs muscle. You have in Aron Kodesh 5 Sefer Torah, and only one is going to be read, so that's the lucky one. So Janusz Korczak, what he did was really, really heroic. He is remembered as the greatest figure of the Holocaust, particularly by people who are not religious. I'm going to burst that bubble in a moment. Because of what he did for children, which for a second I'm not belittling, there are other people who did the same thing he did. There was a religious person in Krakow who also had an orphanage, did the same work as Dr. Korczak, but he's just, people don't know who he was. Or Dr. Ernst, I forgot his last name. That proves that we don't. Korczak was actually, his name was Henrik Goldschmidt. When he was 9 years old, he learned that he was Jewish. When he was 9 years old, his parakeet, he was from extremely secular Jewish family. It's hard to say assimilated, because Poland didn't really allow you to assimilate. Extremely secular Jewish family, and when he was 9 years old, his parakeet died. He went outside to bury his parakeet, and naturally, like he saw, like any 9-year-old boy, he put a cross as the grave marker for the parakeet. And the son of the janitor of the building told him, "You can't put a cross there. The bird is a Jew, like you. And therefore, he can't put on a cross. He's not going to heaven." Now, Goldschmidt himself didn't know that he was Jewish. But it's an amazing thing. In America, as I'm sure you know, people make fun of Poles for being dumb. There's probably a reason for that. But imagine a janitor in Poland. Imagine a janitor's son. How smart could he be? But they were geniuses when they knew to detect who was a Jew. Goldschmidt himself didn't know it, but he knew it. That was his great arousal, that he was Jewish. He became a medical doctor and a very, very famous educator in Poland. He was called the Old Doctor. And he had a radio show every day. When his radio show came on, in schools, they put down the radio, and everybody, expression from the 50s was, watching the radio. They would sit down and hear his voice crackle over, and all the kids would watch the radio. Housewives would take off their aprons and sit down and learn how to become a proper educator and a parent. Machinists would put down their wares and listen to Korczak. He was a national hero. He had two orphanages, a Jewish orphanage and a general orphanage, and it was considered to be the most advanced orphanages in the world because techniques he employed. I don't know your name, but you said it quite right. He looked at children like adults. His perspective was that children are adults with small feet. But I've tried this. I can't speak to a kid like I speak to an adult. I can't do it. I mean, I probably could, but I can't. And when he was given the deportation order to go into the ghetto, he had a truck full of potatoes. And he insisted that his truck be brought into the ghetto. Now, he would not wear the Jewish star, which they forced everyone to wear. He said, I only listen to laws of man, and I only listen to laws of God and of nature. And I will not listen to this law. So he went to argue with the Gestapo that he has to get his truck of potatoes inside. And they saw a Jew who was wearing a military uniform, because he was a Polish national. And, by the way, prior to the war, when Pilsudski was died, the only way they realized they would be successful, their party, in coming to elections again, is to become more anti-Semitic than anti-Semites. And then there was a race in Poland, who could be more anti-Semitic than the next. It started with a reason to win the elections, and as a popular platform, and then it just fed upon itself. And they figured at the end it's just inappropriate. He had a non-Jewish name to be on the radio, Janusz Korczak, but then they said, just we can't have a Jew on the radio. So he was taken off the radio. A lesser man would have been too insulted by this and would have left the country. And he had been in Palestine already 4 times. He had a great desire to come to Israel, but it really wasn't the question. As much as it would have been convenient for him to leave, especially after he was taken off the radio, he just couldn't abandon the children. Then they took away from him his children, took away the non-Jewish orphanage. He's left the Jewish orphanage. And now all he left was a truck of potatoes to bring them to his children. He went to the Gestapo, he argued with them, and finally, they agreed that he could bring the potatoes into the ghetto, but because he argued with the Gestapo and wasn't wearing a Jewish star, he was sent to the Pawiak prison, which was hell on earth, as if the ghetto was anything less than hell. He was put in a cell with rapists and murderers. He managed to stay alive by telling them stories, but he said later on he had phobias from this. And then the Jewish community in the ghetto ransomed him by putting together money to ransom him out of prison. He was very much into education, but he felt that now is not a time that you can educate. The way he phrased it was, when you have a hole in the stomach, you can't reach the brain. So he spent his whole day trying to get food in from his sources on the Aryan side, outside the ghetto. And he put an ad in the ghetto newspaper, he needs assistance with the orphanage. And Gutta Eisenzweig, who later will become Gutta Sternbach, reads the advertisement. She wants to help. The first thing, she had a very good spirit. Gutta, that's her name. She's a good person. So in the ghetto of Warsaw, there was 150,000 people without clothing. They'd come from nearby villages, and they came without clothing. And they were so impoverished and so starving that they're just lying on top of each other. And she went to try and help them, and she just ended up throwing up by seeing their horrible state. She couldn't help them. Then she saw the ad in the ghetto newspaper that he needed assistance. So she applied for the job. They had a discussion. She says the most important discussion she ever had in her life. This woman is still alive and well, deep into her 90s, living in Zurich, Gutta Sternbach. And she was educated in Sarah Schneider's seminary in Krakow. And he'd never had a discussion with a religious person before, living in Poland. And they sat up all night long talking about religion. They did that several times. One night he told her he wants to know more about Judaism. He asked her if she could get permission from her family not to go home at the time of the curfew. They stayed up all night long because he saw that she had a way with the children that was so unique. She taught them Emunah. And he became a Baal Tshuva. That's the story which no one knows. He became a Baal Tshuva and he died a Baal Tshuva. They made for him a machzer and a Haggadah with a Polish translation. And the famous scene I call this the first protest march of history, when Korczak must march with the children to the Amschlagplatz, where they're going to be taken to Treblinka. And it's been described. Let me read it to you. I'll read this to you. Okay. this is the discussion of Korzhak's march with the children. He had them dressed in their finest clothing to walk with dignity. He made a flag for them, and they sang, holding hands, all the way to the Ungshanplatz when they got onto the boxcars. Korzhak, any picture of him or any statue of him is always with children. That was his life. This is from the book The Destruction of Warsaw. A miracle occurred. 200 children did not cry out. 200 pure souls condemned to death did not weep. Not one of them ran away. No one tried to hide. Like stricken swallows, they clung to their teacher and mentor, to their father and brother, Janusz Korzhak, that might protect and preserve them. Janusz Korzhak was marching, his body bent forward, holding the hand of a child in both hands, without a hat, a leather belt around his waist, and wearing high boots. A few nurses marched behind him, wearing white aprons. They were followed by 200 children dressed in clean and meticulously cared for clothes, being carried to the altar. On all sides, the children were surrounded by German, Ukrainian, and this time also Jewish policemen. They whipped and fired shots at them. The very stones of the street wept at the sight of this procession. As Janusz Korzhak neared the Umschlagplatz, the ghetto police stood at attention and saluted. This is the first act of resistance in the Warsaw ghetto, saluting a fellow Jew. According to one report, a German officer made his way toward Korzhak in the commotion at the last moment and handed him a letter permitting him to return home. The Polish underground had arranged for him. They said that he was a sanitation engineer and he was necessary to work in the sewers. According to a different version, when children were already loaded onto the boxcar, a Nazi officer turned to the old doctor and asked, "Was it you who wrote Little Jack, one of his many books?" "Yes, a fine book. I read it when I was a child. You may step out of the wagon." "And the children?" "The children will continue their journey. You, however, can stay behind." "You're mistaken," Korzhak replied. "Not everyone is a rascal." And he remained with his children. It was unthinkable for him to go to his freedom and leaving the children behind. And in Treblinka, as you shall see, there are stone memorials for the communities that perished. Unsdorf, Mattersdorf. And the larger community, Lodz, is a much larger stone than Mattersdorf. Warsaw's larger stone than Lodz. The largest stone says on a Korzhak. Not that he was a community, not that he was a city, but he was just a larger-than-life hero, Korzhak. The connection was that he was sent to the Pawiak prison. That's exactly where Gute Sternbach was sent, because she had a Panamanian passport. Hilla Zeiden was going to join her, faking as if he's same age, looking like her father. And so with that, I want to tell you, I have all of... just a few minutes left. We spoke about the shtetl. How religious do we have to be to the subject? Very religious. Very religious. We spoke about the silly question. I didn't mean that. Who said that? Who asked that question? Okay. We spoke about the shtetl, we spoke about the city. There's one more thing in between. But that's going to be in the war period, and that's the ghetto. Because that's a novum in... Now, the ghetto is not something which was unique. It's been done before. Basically, Hitler just copied. There's only thing that the Nazis had created which had not existed before. The concentration camp already existed in the Boer War. Then the British created that. And the ghetto was already in medieval Italy. But there's a big difference. The ghetto, Jews went to willingly in the time of the medieval period for their own safety, because the Christians on a Sunday were just too dangerous to be exposed. You needed to be locked in for your own protection. In this case, the ghetto was a death trap. A standard procedure was the Nazis, before they would invade a town or area, they'd let the locals run amok. And they would take the Jews, they would burn them, they would knife them, they would beat them, they would club them, they would certainly rob them. And then the Nazis came to town and said, "Listen here, you see the locals hate you, your only chance to survive is to go into the ghetto." And they ran into the death trap in order to save themselves. It was always done like this. They were told, "You have 1 hour to go into the ghetto." There's a word in German for it, so it was done very, very quickly. You're only allowed to take 5 kilo of material with you. Why was it done so quickly, with just 1 hour's notice? Because if it's done quickly, then you have no time to start negotiating selling your items. You have no time to conceal them, to bury them. You only have time to get your most, what you consider your most valuable things, and then leave everything else that's very convenient for the Germans to come and confiscate whatever possessions that you have. So the concentration camps exist, the ghetto exists, and yet the ghetto is something which is totally novel. The ghetto which existed in the medieval period never mimicked this kind of ghetto. It's like people apply terms like, we live in the Jewish ghetto, like Lawrence, you know, or Beverly Hills, the Jewish ghetto. They're not referring to the ghetto from the Holocaust. They're not even referring to the ghetto from the medieval period. They mean an area where Jews are congregated. Ghetto, it's not. Life in the ghetto was not life that was worth living. If you can say such an expression, it was absolutely torturous. In many ways, more dangerous than life in the concentration camps. And I've taken you already last year to Yad Vashem. I'm sure you're right. Some of you, none of you. Some of that. Okay, so I was thinking, but it's not the whole Tarshaga. I'm taking guys that are. My plan was, when I actually thought out what I'm going to say, I would talk about the ghetto, because that's the third area where Jews lived. But then I might as well say thunder for actual Yad Vashem. With our Jewish life in Poland. That Jewish life. Okay, just aware of one statistic, which I have to end with, is that it's a fact that we lost 1/3 of our people in the Holocaust. That number, that's a true figure. But it's not reflected from a religious perspective. Religious perspective, we didn't lose 1/3 of our people. We lost over 90%. The heart and soul of religious Jewry was in Poland, Hungary, Romania, White Russia. That was not decimated, that was annihilated. Totally destroyed. And the religious Jews were the greatest korbanos in the Holocaust. Why is that? And it's not because the Nazis had a greater dislike of religious Jews than non-religious Jews. They made no distinction. If you were Jewish, you went to your death. Even if four generations you were not Jewish, if it were traced back, you would go to your death. Tortured and go to death. So why were religious ones the greatest victims? Not such a profound answer. Simply because the religious Jews were just more profoundly, Jewish looking. It was easier to spot the ones that were religious. So if you're a religious Jew, then it was much quicker that you go to your death. Whereas those that were not so religious looking, they stood a better chance of trying to conceal their Judaism until they had total cooperation of everyone to spot out who the ones were Jews, even though they didn't look like Jews. Jewish life in Poland was confined to the Jewish areas, be it the cities we've described in the Shtetlach, but didn't go elsewhere. That is why the resistance movement and the question why didn't they fight back was because they really couldn't fight back. Resistance presupposes you have a place to hide, a place to go to, outside sources. For a Jew to leave the ghetto, no one would give him shelter. No one. No Pole, no Ukrainian would hide a Jew. So if you run away, there's nowhere to run away to. People on the outside will hand you over. If you saw the movie The Pianist, or if you read the book The Pianist, you have that choice. Anyone? Someone? So that is the exception which proves the rule. He was able to escape because he knew people on the outside. He had Aryan connections, but he was the only one. No one else had connections that would be able to protect him. Okay, I'm sorry that time's lapsed. Thank you.